gentlemen, I had no idea I was broadcasting.
All you had to do was to flip this key down and you're on the air.
But I was nowhere near that key. And if anyone did flip it down, it was an accident.
Behind the scenes of T's Guest again. Welcome aboard the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. How are you? We made it to Friday, a crazy, chaotic week. We'll recap all the sideshow festivities in the free-flow pop culture convo coming up. Inspiration to action shout-outs. Hey, listen, I have a motivational jumpstart ready-made for procrastinators as we continue our season of renewal. We'll get you in the mix, too. 347-857-4505 if you're listening live, Friday, November 7th at 9 a.m. out west, 11 central, noon here in the east. A couple of musical birthdays, too. That's all coming your way. Twitter feed available at AB Writes. The show today being brought to you in part by Frosted Mini Wheats. It's a win-win, nutritious and delicious for breakfast. And by PopNet, new and improved. It's arts, culture, conversation on the air, online, 24-7, the new improved PopNet. The Lincoln Motor Company, the perfect blend of style, luxury, and tradition, right in your moment with the Lincoln Motor Company and the Oak Center for Lifelong Learning. It's never too late to embrace your dreams and live the life you've always wanted. Find out more at oakcenterlearning.org. Delighted to welcome our guests to the show. It's always a pleasure to welcome fellow authors into the mix, and today we have best-selling author David Laskin, who has written a slew of books, including the 2004 bestseller, The Children's Blizzard. His latest book, which has gotten all kinds of great reviews, is called The Family. It is an exploration of his own family and, by extension, the entire 20th century. It is a pleasure to welcome David to the show. David, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Amy. Great to be here.
Good to have you here. Let's talk a little bit about, before we get into why you picked your family, the notion of what narrative nonfiction is and what it means to you. I know storytelling is so important to us on this show and to you, and it's interesting, as I was reading up on you, to find that you were lured into storytelling by one of the great books as a kid, Huckleberry Finn, which is, of course, a great yarn and a fictional yarn. What made you decide to go from fiction, and obviously you devoted your life to nonfiction?
Right. Well, yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Huckleberry Finn, because that was really the first book that hooked me in a way that I just could not escape from its spell. And, yes, of course, that's fiction, but, you know, that's my goal in writing nonfiction. I want to write history, true stories, in a way that hook people in and make it impossible for them to escape from that spell. So it's sort of using the tools, the tricks, the craft of a novelist, but applying that to history. That's really my approach. So when people read the books, they get swept up just as you do when you're reading a great novel, but it's all true. It's based on memoirs, it's based on letters, it's based on archival research. It's really history told the way I most enjoy getting history, which is person to person, family to family. That's the kind of book I write, and that's the kind of book I love to read.
Sure, because it brings it all to life, too. It's not just cold facts. You're having
exactly.
These stories come to life,
right,
with these people.
Yeah. You know, I was just reading something about Anne Frank the other day that I think she gets, there are 2 million people a year go to visit the house in which the Frank family lived and hid during the Holocaust. And, you know, I think it's that one person, you know, the one, I think Anne Frank in many ways has become the face of the Holocaust. And, you know, you can read statistics, you can read accounts, you can read analyses, but when it's one little girl and her struggle to hide and escape from the Nazis and her failure to do so, that's what compels us. And certainly that's what compels me. And those are the kinds of books that, as I said, I try to write.
Sure, you want to bring that experience to life as best you can. But you do admit, I think, interestingly enough, in your book, The Family, and again, we'll talk about some of the characters that you've uncovered and stories that were unveiled, that you do have, to talk about Huck Finn again, a couple of stretchers where things kind of get embroiled and, there's some fantastical tales as we all tell. I mean, that's what storytelling is all about. When you hand stories down from one generation to the next, we kind of embroider on it as we go, right?
Yeah, right. I think especially family stories, there are quite a number of stretchers, you know, things that kind of maybe go a little bit beyond belief. But, that's part of my job. You know, we grow up hearing the stories that our parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, what have you, tell. We, you know, believe them or just absorb them and pass them down to some extent. But then when you sit down as a professional writer and want to write the history of your family or write your memoir, that's when research comes in. And that's when you start to look at history, look at archives, look at facts, and compare those to this family stories. And, you know, I have to say from my own experience, my mother is a great embellisher and a great storyteller, and my brothers and I always joke about, oh, you know, Mom, you know, she's told the story a million times. It's, you know, there's probably a kernel of truth. Well, you know, some of the stories she told me actually checked out, you know, fact by fact. Others didn't.
Well,
they got colorful.
They got more colorful along the way because that's probably where you got your storytelling gift, right?
Oh,
your mom probably had that.
She'd be the first to say amen to that, yeah. So, but, you know, I think there's some things that are just completely that do get kind of fabricated, that get added into the family mix. And, you know, as you said, elaborated or more highly colored, and then when you start checking the facts, you're going, whoa, no, this never happened. Or, you know, for example, in my family, there was this myth that one of Stalin's evil henchmen, Lazar Kahanovich, was a cousin of my grandfather's. Well, the name was Kahanovich before they changed it to Cohen, and so same name, you know, it sounded plausible. I saw a picture of him in a history book. He didn't look that different from my grandfather and his brothers, but, you know, did a little bit of research, and these days there's no excuse not to do your research. I mean, when you've got the internet and you can't find everything there, but you can find a lot, and some things you can find very easily. It turns out Lazar lived in Ukraine, my family lived in Belarus, I got the family tree, he was not on it, so that was a stretcher, and that got tossed into the junk pile.
Now, was anybody in your family dismayed that you debunked some of the myths that came down the pike and had to tell the truth? Were they sort of disappointed?
Not really. You know, one element of the book, and maybe for your listeners, I should just kind of sketch in the kind of the big picture of the book.
Sure.
This is, as you said, a history of my family. It's really my mother's family, and the family divided into three branches. One came here to the U.S. and went into business, and one of the businesses that my family started was the Maiden Form Bra Company. So this hugely successful, sexy, glamorous, you know, underwear company that started in the 1920s. That's branch number one. My grandfather also went into business. Branch number two went to what was Palestine, now Israel, and these were idealistic Zionist pioneers who were really involved in the founding of the Jewish state, and they were very determined to make the desert bloom, very propelled by their socialist Zionist beliefs and dreams. And the third branch remained behind in what was Europe and all perished in the Holocaust. So it's really kind of, as you said, the big sweep of 20th century history, particularly 20th century Jewish history, in one family tree. So getting back to your question, most, I would say 99% of my family was thrilled with the whole idea of the book, on board from day one. I interviewed pretty much every living relative, got their stories, particularly the older people. The book is really about one generation of cousins. I've talked a little bit about my grandfather. Idle into the world is Ida Rosenthal, was the founder of the Maiden Form Bra Company. She was my grandfather's sister, and they had cousins. You know, the ones who went to Palestine were cousins. Well, so talk to the, you know, there are a couple of cousins in that generation who are still alive. They're in their 90s. They have great memories, and they were fantastic interviews. The only kind of exception to the rule came with the Maiden Form family, the descendants of my great-aunt Idle, her granddaughters, are still alive. The company went bankrupt under their control in the 1980s, I believe, or 1990s, and they were not happy about the idea that the Maiden Form story would be told. So, you know, it wasn't that they blocked publication, but they just said, well, you know, we really don't feel comfortable with this book. Everybody else in the family, 100% on board. And, you know, I'm actually speaking to you from San Francisco. I did a talk last night at the Jewish Community Library, and sure enough, family members showed up. I mean, pretty much wherever I go, there's somebody who comes out of the woodwork and, hey, I'm your second cousin, twice removed, what have you, and it's been great. So, yeah, it's been quite a journey. And, you know, and I also feel like I've connected with a lot of family and a lot of readers as well.
What drew you to this story? Was it because you really just wanted to uncover, finally tell your own family story, or because you really thought it was a nice connective tissue to all these, as you said, epic episodes in American history?
Right. You know,
world history.
It was actually something else that drew me to it. And, you know, when I started researching the book, and, you know, I'm a professional writer. I've written many other books, as you mentioned, none about my own family or my own life. And that, you know, I was in my late 50s when I began poking around about, you know, maybe let's look into the family. I knew by the maiden-formed connection, so I thought that might be kind of an interesting way to start. And, you know, I asked my mom, well, you know, tell me what you know about the family history, the family tree. And she said, well, you know, I don't really know all that much more than what you know. Why don't you contact your, we have relatives in Israel. And I had met one of them, this big, big family there, but I really was not aware of most of them and had certainly never met them or heard their stories. But, you know, with the wonders of email, it was very easy to get in touch. They have, their English is quite good. And so we started emailing back and forth, and they said, well, you know, if you really want to know about the family history, you should go on this website that we put together. Clicked into it, and there were these photographs of attractive men and women and their children wearing little sailor suits and had ribbons in their hair, you know, the way kids dressed up back in the old days, and all of them were killed in the Holocaust. And I thought, these are my relatives. I've never heard their names. I've never heard their stories. This, you know, again, Mike, these are my grandfather's first cousins and their children. Wow. You know, of course, growing up Jewish, you know, anyway, everybody knows about the Holocaust. We all assume, oh, well, you know, this happened. This is a terrible tragedy to the Jewish people. I never knew it happened to my family, to my grandfather's cousins. So that was really the catalyst when I thought, whoa, A, we have this story in the family tree, and B, I'd never heard of it and never knew of it. I kind of, that was when I really became obsessed with uncovering whatever I could, with traveling back to the places where my family members lived and died, and with telling the story. So that was really the catalyst for it all.
That's a very profound experience. Do you know why nobody mentioned it? Was it? I mean, they must have known. Somebody in your had to know that there were people that died in the Holocaust.
Right.
They were trying to shield people from it, eradicate it from your own family history, or just it was too horrific to discuss.
I think it's more the latter. You know, I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I've met and interviewed many, many relatives, and many have come to talks, and I always bring this up. You know, did you know you had family who were killed in the Holocaust? No. And I wouldn't say it was a secret. It wasn't like some dark thing that nobody, you know, that people try to eradicate or bury. It was more a question of, we don't talk about it. And, you know, I've spoken with many other families, and this is a very common theme. And in fact, let's broaden it out from the Holocaust to genocide in general. You know, there have been studies of how genocide is discussed and memorialized in families. And I think it's pretty well established that in the immediate generations, and, you know, whether we're talking about Bosnia or Rwanda or what have you, or the Holocaust in Europe, the immediate generations, now I'm talking about my grandparents and my parents who lived through it. I mean, they were here, so they didn't endure it, but they lived at the time that it happened. Those people rarely want to talk about it, discuss it, revisit it. It's kind of unspeakable. It's too painful. It's too raw. It's too shameful. And so they put it behind them, or they put it out of their minds. And it's really the subsequent generations. And, you know, I'm the perfect kind of demographic here. This happened to my grandfather's generation, and it's really the second and third generations down that begin to do the research, that begin to put the pieces together, put names to faces, and tell the stories and find out what happened. So I think I am fair, you know, I think what I've done is fairly common among families that have been touched by genocide. And as I said, in traveling and speaking with other families, I've heard many similar stories.
Now, when you talk about shameful, you mentioned, what does the shame come from? The fact that it happened, the fact that we couldn't prevent it from happening? Because I know there are a lot of people that feel, you know, did the Jews see there were some warning signs, and why did they let it happen? Why didn't they get out sooner? All of those kinds of things. Is that something that you think is wrapped up in?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think, you know, survivor's guilt is well established. Even if you didn't, you know, even if you tried your best to save your family members, even if you did everything you could, if you were partisan, if you fought against the Nazis, I think there's still this terrible shame that this happened to your people. and you couldn't stop it or you didn't stop it. And I think it's just, you know, the sense of why me? Why did I survive? And I also just think in the Holocaust, I think it's very hard to get your head around the fact that so many millions of people were killed without fighting back. And that's a very fraught subject, and I think it explains some of contemporary politics in Israel, the kind of very staunch military culture that has imbued Israeli society from the start, this sense of never again. We will not go like sheep to the slaughter. And I think there are many reasons why that happened, and Primo Levi writes about it at great length in his books about Auschwitz and his time at Auschwitz. And it's complicated. I certainly don't want to be in a position of saying, you know, they were cowards or anything like that. I feel far from that. I feel that in many ways, the people who didn't fight, there was a heroic quality to their lives. But nonetheless, I think that is part of the shame, the sense of how could we have let this happen? And yeah, it's complicated. I mean, I don't think there's any one strand that we can point to, but I think they all get wrapped up in there. And then I think for American Jews, it's particularly complicated because this happened to our cousins or overseas. And even though the U.S. did join the war in 1941, by then the Holocaust was well in progress. And could we have done more? Could we have found out more? And, you know, the whole question of how much American Jews knew and how much American Jews did is very fraught. And I can tell you when the book has been chosen by many reading groups, and when I often try to join the discussions by Skype or phone or sometimes in person, and this question always comes up, you know, why didn't your family do more? Could they have done more to get the relatives out? So very, very painful. And I think that's all part of the package of this, how just very difficult it is to face this chapter in history, but how important it is and how essential really to tell the story.
And you also talk about the fact that growing up on Long Island, you know, suburban New York, you really weren't very religious per se, but you do feel a connection culturally, obviously, to Judaism. You do feel a connection to your relatives who are in Israel. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. You know, I think like many Americans and let's say American Jews, you know, I felt certainly strongly identified with Judaism and with my heritage, my culture, to some extent my religion. I've never been a very religious person. I don't go to synagogue, and I'm not a big one for prayer. But definitely strongly identified with that part of my identity. But I think when I started researching the book and discovered that I am descended from a long line of scribes, you know, Torah scribes, these people who copied the five books of the Torah, you know, letter by letter onto parchment. And this goes back to my grandfather, great-great, you know, back to the three greats and probably beyond that, but that's as far back as I've been able to trace it. And when I realized, you know, I'm a kind of scribe too. I mean, I don't copy the Torah, but I write stories, as we said when the show started, you know, I tell these true stories, not only of my own family, but of other people's families. That made me realize, maybe in the most powerful way I ever had, how connected I am with the family tradition, with the family lineage, with this desire to record in words. And I think that sense of connection started with the family and extended to Judaism, to my Jewish heritage. And so do I go to synagogue, you know, tomorrow, Saturday, am I going to go off to synagogue? No, I wish I could say I would. And there are probably some readers out there saying, for shame. That's not me. I'm not a religious, traditionally religious Jew, but I am a deeply reverent Jew. And I've become all the more so as a result of delving into my family story. So I would say, you know, as I said, I'm in San Francisco. I gave a talk last night, and I think one of the things that I love about Judaism is that, you know, we run the gamut from super religious Jews who, you know, just follow every rule to people, you know, I think Reform Judaism today is very open. It's very loose. It's very welcoming, and we have all those different stripes. Do we argue? Of course we argue. I mean, this is part, we're humans, and this is like maybe something that, that Jews have a, well, certainly not a monopoly on, but are very, very good at, you know, splitting hairs and arguing doctrine. But I do think it's,
yeah,
it's great to have this big tent and to feel that there's place for everybody, and I love that.
Yeah, if there, if you really do believe that, I think as you get further out with any religion to the more fundamentalists, they're not opening the tent so wide.
No, that's true. But right, but I think there are parts of the tent that are firmly shut. And I know from doing genealogical research that there are particularly Jews of Spanish descent who, you know, whose families were forced to convert and who have tried to come back to Judaism, saying, you know, I've done some family research and it turns out even though I was raised Catholic, I'm actually Jewish. And the Orthodox rabbis are like, no, sorry, it's not good enough. You need to prove it. And I feel like, whoa, if you want to come back, I would be happy to have you. You know, but yeah, there's a fringe group that's always going to be, we have the rules, we're more holy than thou, you know, get the heck out of here. But I think one thing that's really cool about Judaism is that it does come in many different varieties. And I mean, I've spoken at a lot of synagogues, and there was one that I spoke at in Stockton, California, large Hispanic community. And I would say, you know, a quarter of the congregation was Hispanic. You know, Hispanics who were raised either Catholic or Pentecostal who just feel more comfortable in a Reformed Jewish synagogue for whatever reasons, and they were happy to have them. And I think this that's my brand of Judaism.
Yeah, me too. I'm an ultra-Reformed Jew, I would say.
Good, you know,
talk a
we're
little
on
bit,
the same page there.
Talk about getting from the religious aspects of the family to the entrepreneurial side and your great aunt, Ida, who founded Maiden Form Company. I mean, a woman at that time, too, to found a company which was widely successful despite the problems they may have had later on.
Right.
Talk a little bit about her and how she started this and what you found out
about
her.
Yeah, she was a force of nature. You know, I knew her a little bit. I can't say we were super close. She lived in this huge mansion on Long Island with a private beach and a private ballroom and tennis courts and grounds. And, you know, I was not raised that way. People are like, oh, great, you have the maiden for money. No. That was not my brand. So and then we got nice Hanukkah presents from her, like $10, which back then seemed like a fortune. And that was about all the maiden for money that ever came my way. But, yeah, so, you know, she's a fascinating person. She really was a force of nature, and she did it her way. You know, you have to kind of put this in context. She was born in 1885. Her father was super Orthodox, religious, Torah-studying scribe. So, you know, daughters back then were supposed to, you know, do housework, get married, you know, make chicken soup, and keep their heads down. And she was like, to heck with that. You know, well, that's not who I am. And she basically wrote her own rules. And, you know, the mother bought her a sewing machine thinking, okay, well, you know, she'll earn some money that way. And, you know, she learned how to sew, but that was just the beginning. She really had this strong entrepreneurial streak. She was very bossy, which came in very handy when you were running a big company.
Sure,
she was very decisive. She was a revolutionary. She started life as a socialist revolutionary, and she kind of took it into lingerie and, you know, became a wildly successful capitalist. But, you know, she always voted. She kept those left-wing politics. So a really complicated person, very literate, very well-educated, self-taught, you know, very strong-willed, and a visionary. I mean, back then, you know, Maiden Form was really made. People in the family said, oh, well, you know, your Aunt Idle invented the bra. No, she didn't invent the bra. There were bras. There were many other companies, and the brassiere had been around for 20 or 30 years by the 1920s when she started Maiden Form. Her genius was not invention. Her genius was branding. She took this product, this flimsy little bra, and she turned it into a household word pretty much single-handedly. I mean, obviously she had a big staff and knew how to do it. But, you know, she was very bold about advertising. the famous dream campaign, which I understand is still referenced in Mad Men shows. I dreamed I did whatever in the maiden, my maiden form bra.
Yeah, right.
You know, women, older women will remember that. And, you know, there were these gorgeous models were out and about just wearing just these pointy little bras on top and, you know, whatever, dressed normally underneath. But they were out being politicians. They were out being firefighters. They were out playing pool, whatever. Absurd, crazy, amusing things that really made Maiden Form a household name. And Idyll was behind that. So, yeah, she certainly was a role model, kind of an early feminist dynamo pioneer tycoon. If she were here right now, and if she were on your show, and boy, wouldn't that be cool? And if you were to say, you know, so talk about feminism, she would say, feminism. I'm not feminist. Oh, I don't believe in feminism. But she didn't. Maybe she didn't believe in it, but she certainly practiced it. She walked the walk, even if she didn't talk the talk. And you know, I think she's just part of that generation. And in many ways, I think this is the greatest generation. These immigrant ancestors of ours, and I don't know what your family story is, but, you know, I would say the common American Jewish family story is came through Ellis Island, went to the Lower East Side or, you know, some slummy neighborhood and worked their way up. And some worked their way up faster than others. Idyll was right, you know, racing out of the blocks and made a fortune.
Yeah, wow.
Really all by
herself. All that ambition.
Yeah,
all that talent,
sure.
Ambition, vision, as
mm-hmm.
you said, all of that rolled into one. It's great.
Yeah.
Now, was she around long enough to see the company fall into disrepair, or was she?
No. She the company, she passed it on to her daughter, Bea, and Bea made even more money. And the company was doing very, very well. And Idyll had a stroke, I think, in the 1970s, and really was not aware of much. And then I can't remember exactly when she died, but I think in the early 80s. So the company was prospering throughout her life, so she never knew what happened to it. Which
and what did happen
well.
To it? I mean, why did it...
Okay, so the company, the granddaughters inherited it, Idyll's two granddaughters, and for various reasons, bad business decisions, bad business climate, they got overextended with debt, they bankrupted it. So the company went bankrupt, the trademark passed out of the family. A lot of people lost their pensions. There was a lot of bitterness about this. And there are still Maiden Form bras, but they are no longer sold out of my family. And I think it's now part of the Hanes empire. So, you know, I mean, there's that old expression from shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. And that's exactly the story of my family. You know, it was founded, it flourished, and it went bankrupt in three generations. Mm. And so it's an amazing story, but yeah, there's certain sadness that I feel that this immigrant dynamo, you know, was hoping to start this dynasty, and it really didn't last very long.
Didn't last as long. Well, it's something about, as you're right, about Jewish families and all immigrant families, I think, too, the idea of the business and having the family business, and it is kind of sad when these businesses either, you know, fall into disrepair or are sold because nobody wants to do it and they sell it to somebody else or they sell it to a corporation or that kind of thing. And it kind of loses something. So if you have a family business, it's a great thing to be able to hold on to it.
I agree.
And on as possible, I think. It's great.
But
what a rich stories, multiple stories you tell, different branches of your family that do, as we said, kind of do weave that tapestry of 20th century history and the experiences that so many people go through. And I think that you're right about the idea that you want to get the right story and the right people in that story. I mean, you have an idea, you have these colorful people come to life, that makes people more intrigued by it and read it. Have you ever thought about doing a novel, or you just really like narrative nonfiction?
You know, narrative nonfiction really sparks my imagination. I think I need that sort of backboard of fact to imagine. I know it sounds funny because you think, oh, imagination, you can just make stuff up. I'm not ruling it out. I have, in the way, way in the distant past, I did write a couple of novels that are sitting in a drawer or a box somewhere. So I definitely am intrigued by that form. But, you know, I'm reading this book now. Yale Doctorow's Ragtime, and of course became very famous as a Broadway show, and it's probably a movie. And I just think it's such a cool book, and I don't know why I had never read it before, but I love the way he mixes fact and fiction. I mean, he's got historical figures. You know, there's Emma Goldman, the anarchist, and Stanford White, the architect, and they're all kind of swirling around in this narrative, but they're also people who are made up and kind of float in and out. And I'm thinking, that's kind of a cool approach. So that something like that may be in the future for me. But meanwhile, I've loved writing these fact-based fact-based stories. And, you know, for the family, I think one of the great advantages I had, and I think anybody who's tried to write memoir or family history would relate to this, about halfway into the project, I discovered that there were 281 family letters, and nobody had read them in years and years because they were all written in Yiddish, and they were in the possession of my Israeli cousins. And they had never read them because they don't know Yiddish either. Yiddish has pretty much died out in Israel, and it's dying here in the States, but we had them all translated, and that was just amazing. And, you know, one of the many, and there are many, many rich discoveries in the letters, but one of them, which I think really helped tie the book together and make it as coherent and as powerful as it is that I discovered that the three branches of this family were very much aware and in touch and close with each other. It wasn't, you know, some families, I think, immigrate, they go their separate ways. There's, oh, there's Great Aunt Minnie somewhere. I don't know what the hell she's doing. But, you know, my family was not like that. They were very aware. My great-grandfather was sending money to the relatives in Palestine. Sometimes the same letter would be sent from Poland to New York onto Palestine. It would make the full circuit. They were very, the names, you know, they were the ones in Poland during the war were very aware of the U.S. family and, you know, how Idle was this tycoon. So they were very, very close, and there were visits back and forth. Idle's husband went back to Poland right before the war started. One of the Israelis' grandfather came to New York to visit my family again right before the war started. So there was just lots of kind of cross-pollinization and communication that bound them very close together. So this is a story of three branches that really felt a strong kinship. And I think the loss of the third branch has brought the remaining two branches together. And I've become very close with the Israeli branch. And as a result of the book, many of my American relatives have gone to Israel and really bonded with the family there. So that is very important and very special to me as well.
I was going to say, that's a wonderful byproduct of this book, personally, absolutely. For you and your family. That's
great.
Yeah,
for sure.
Fabulous. Yeah. Fabulous stories. People can find out more about it. I know you're getting great reviews already at your website, davidlaskin.com. It's The Family. We should mention the subtitle is A Journey into the Heart of the 20th Century. David, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us. I really appreciate it, and I hope you
come
back and see
us. Oh, my pleasure. Great, great show. Thanks so much.
Take care. David Laskin,
okay,
find out
too.
More, davidlaskin.com. This is the Beth Arkley Show. Give us a call, 347-857-4505. Twitter feed also at AB Writes. And welcome back. It is the Abby Beth Arkley Show. How are you? Reach out via Twitter to Abby Writes. A couple of folks chiming in. Shay says, another fabulous interview. Thank you. Well, thank you, Shay. Always appreciate it. And Tanya says, intriguing. I will check out the book. All right. We got you some new readers already, David. Again, find out more about the family at David Laskin's website, davidlaskin.com. So you survived, right? Election day? No great surprises, I guess, except the Republican wins were more than they thought, perhaps. But you know what I said on Tuesday, and I think this may be true, if turnout had been higher, and I said turnout could have been the game changer if there was a bigger turnout, we could have seen profound differences in some of those races because there were a couple of razor-thin victories that went to the Republicans, like in North Carolina, for example. So who knows? But we got what we got. It's another divided government. Will they work together? Won't they work together? I have a feeling, if I look into my crystal ball, obstructionism is still in the future in Washington, D.C., but we'll see what happens. Let's hope for the best. Congratulations to the winners and to everybody else. There's always another day, as they say. Except for some people. I think some people should just say it's enough. Like Martha Coakley in deep, deep blue Massachusetts. She was a horrible Senate candidate, and she couldn't make it as governor either. So maybe she should say, you know what? I'm not running anymore. Here's Mellencamp on the Internet Dark Show. We'll be right back. Campaign trail, John Mellencamp's I'm Not Running Anymore. On the Amy Beth Orkowitz Show, the rest of us, if we voted, preserved our right to gripe. If not, I don't want to hear from you. Reach out via Twitter at AB Writes. Studio line also, if you're listening live, 347-857-4505. Did you catch the CMAs, the Country Music Awards, the other night? To be honest, I just saw a smattering of it. But there was some controversy, I guess, kicked up with the humor between co-host Brad Paisley and Carrie Underwood, who have been doing it for about 7 years together, so they have great chemistry. And actually, I thought it was spot on. They did a very fitting parody song called Quarantine to the tune of Dolly Parton's classic Jolene, which was just great. And there was one controversial joke, but I thought it was spot on, too, from Brad Paisley, who said the show aired on Wednesday night on ABC during a time when the sitcom Blackish would be on. And he said, if people are expecting Blackish, well, you got something else. You've got Whitish, referring, of course, to the fact that, with the possible exception of Darius Rucker, there are very few black people in the country music scene. And some people thought that went too far, but I think it was just spot on and telling it like it is. But country music has come a long way. Look at who won as the big winners. Now, Luke Bryan was the entertainer of the year, but the big winner of the night were two ladies, Miranda Lambert, who cleaned up as single of the year with her great song Automatic. We're going to hear that in a moment, as well as a female vocalist of the year. And she also won for Album of the Year with Platinum. And her hubby, Blake Shelton, won for Male Vocalist, so there's no fighting at home, I guess. They were both nominated for Entertainer of the Year. Fortunately, Luke Bryan won, so they didn't have to go home and have any kind of a kerfuffle over that. But another big winner was Kacey Musgraves, who I believe won the Best New Artist last year. This year, she won Song of the Year for the song Follow Your Arrow, which is so groundbreaking, especially in country music, when you listen to the lyrics, and I'm going to play it for you now, that it is reminiscent of when Loretta Lynn, many years ago, back in the late 60s, or I guess early 70s, kicked up dust with her song The Pill about the birth control, of course. So give a listen. This is Kacey Musgraves, the Country Music Awards Song of the Year, Follow Your Arrow.
As soon as you down the first one, if you can't lose.
points, taking on gay marriage, drugs, all of it, in Kacey Musgraves' catchy song. On the other hand, you know, progress has been made, but there's some pitfalls, too, as illuminated in Miranda Lambert's single of the year, Automatic. Music and any music scene these days. Great stuff. On the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show Twitter feed available at AB Writes, Johnny Fever's Hangover chiming in says, dang, missed most of the interview, but it seemed interesting. We'll catch the podcast. Yeah, thanks, Johnny. And yeah, that's the beauty of the internet shows. They're all archived for podcasts. So follow the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show at the Blog Talk Radio site. You can download episodes there or at iTunes, NetNow, and at my website, AmyBethArkowitz.com. com. That is also, by the way, the place to go should you want to be a guest on the show. We're rounding out our 2014 season. Wow, I know. Creeping up on us, the holiday season. Wide open, though, for 2015. So, you know, we love compelling storytellers of all types, from authors to filmmakers, musicians to theater folks, personal growth, justice experts, and media mavens, too. Hop over to the website, amybetharkowy.com. Tell us about your story, your project, and we'll see about getting you on the Media Bites award-winning top podcast. They call it an empowering, entertaining tour de force. And who the heck are we to argue with that? Reach out. We'll get you in the mix. The Inspiration to Action Challenge, it's working pretty good. I hope it's working for you. I want to reach out, give a shout-out today to Nellie, who is in Chicago area, Chicagoland, she says, and working on a memoir dissecting all sorts of interesting things from the family. There's some hard stories to get through, and you got me in the right frame of mind, so I thank you for that. I will indeed keep you posted. Well, thank you very much. Nellie, good luck to you. And keep on going. If the Inspiration to Action Challenge is working for you, I'd love to give you a well-deserved shout-out. I think it helps nudge other folks in the right direction. Again, reach out to the website, amybetharkowy.com. That's also the place to go if you need a little cajoling in that department. And we can start a conversation for creativity coaching and or counseling. The first one, always on me. And speaking of motivation and creativity coaching, here's our motivational jumpstart as we continue our season of renewal. And this one is ready-made for procrastinators, and we all know who we are, right? Raise your hands. Okay. It's a quote. I thought about this when I saw this quote yesterday, how profound this is, from Doris Lessing, the great writer. She said, in the writing process, the more a thing cooks, the better. And that kind of means you got to live with it. You got to sit with it sometimes. And I have found that to be true with my own process right now. I have the third book in the Eliza Gordon Mystery Series, and you know I've talked about this, kind of been on a slow simmer on the back burner, and all of a sudden things are starting to come to the life. And I think part of it is because the characters are now ready. And sometimes you have to sit with something. You have to let it come up in its own time. That doesn't mean ignoring it. It doesn't mean putting it in a drawer. It means letting it simmer, letting it take its time. Every project, whether it's a book, certainly in writing, but even visual arts, anything else. Sometimes things, the inspiration has to be there. It has to connect with the muse. It has to connect with the characters, all of that. So you got to let something sit. But active sitting, where you're really concentrating on it, you're working with it, you're sitting with it every day, even if you're not getting a lot of writing done on it, you're concentrating your efforts because you want to be that conduit to those stories to come through you. That's kind of what I believe. You have to really be present for them to emerge and to come from you, come through you onto the page. So keep that in mind. Let it cook. Don't be discouraged. And sometimes things just never come, and then it's time to move on to the next one. But you'll know. You know, people always say, well, how do you know when it's done? How do you know when you should give up? You'll know. It's an instinctive thing. You'll know. The characters will tell you. The thing, the book, the project, whatever it is, will tell you when it's time to move on and maybe abandon it. But give it a chance. Give it a chance to cook. I think you'll do okay with it. And again, reach out if you have any other questions or concerns. I'm here to help you out if I can. Got some great creative folks celebrating birthdays in the last week or so. One impressive man, Art Garfunkel, celebrating his 73rd birthday the other day. Of course, the partner in arguments to Paul Simon, who celebrated his birthday last month. They're both 73 years old. And I remember that song, Old Friends, they did on the Bookends album, where they said, how very strange to be 70, about two old friends on a bench. Well, they've surpassed that, and they still sound good. And Art Garfunkel is an interesting guy because he really was only credited with one co-writing credit in his Simon and Garfunkel days with Scarborough and Canticle Fair. Or are you going to Scarborough Fair and Canticle? I'm sorry. And it's interesting because he published two volumes of poetry, which is intriguing. And I saw a documentary about the two of them when they were young, just starting out, or hitting their stride, not just starting out, but popular already. And he had a lot of ideas about politics and art and literature. And it's funny how he maybe was, you know, pushed out by Paul Simon and the songwriting. But he certainly was the voice of that duo and continued on in his solo career. Still going strong, I think, at 73, taking on the All-American Standard Songbook these days. Here's one of his solo classics, I Shall Sing. It's Art Garfunkel. Happy 73rd birthday on the Amy Biff Arkowy Show.
Mm-hmm.
Art Garfunkel, what a great voice and a great song. Happy 73rd birthday on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. And All I Know and I Shall Stay. Interesting footnote to Art Garfunkel, you may not know. He has a master's degree from Columbia in all things, math. No kidding. Speaking of math teachers, sort of, have you been watching the HBO miniseries Olive Kittredge? Oh, what a brilliant performance. Frances McDormand already top of the short list for the Best Actress Emmy, I'm sure. It is a faithful, I believe, pretty faithful adaptation of Elizabeth Stout's Pulitzer Prize-winning story collection. I read it some years ago, so I don't remember everything about it, but a phenomenal production. So catch it on HBO. They rerun it frequently. If you don't get the premium channel, not to worry. I'm sure it'll be available on DVD and download in short order, as these things usually are. And speaking of HBO, the comeback is making a comeback. That quirky cult favorite with Lisa Kudrow about Valerie Cherish, the has-been actress trying to make a go of it in reality TV, which was kind of ahead of its time. It came out like 9 years ago when reality TV was really in its nascency and became a cult favorite after it was off the air, frankly, because it was rerun on Sundance and other places. And now it's back for a short, I think, 6 or 8 episode run starting this Sunday. So what has Valerie and the gang been up to since? It's a fascinating. It's an acquired taste, not for everybody, but I happen to like it. So check it out if you're so inclined. 347-857-4505, our studio line, and the Twitter feed also buzz at AB Writes. If you have anything to say, get into the mix. Hey there, welcome to the show.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that I enjoyed hearing David Laskin. He brought back memories about I Dream of Blank in my maiden form bra.
You remember those campaigns?
I do, indeed. And they were a lot of fun. And it was. I was sorry to hear, though, that the company went out of the family.
Yeah. Well, that's always a shame. I think it's important, if possible, to keep those, preserve those family businesses, but sometimes it just doesn't work out the way either they make some mistakes or they don't have anybody to pass it on to and it gets sucked up by another corporation, so it's hard, but it's a great thing when they can remain in the family. I agree with that. And he was right. He mentioned that Mad Men, I think, did use that campaign.
Yes. Yes, they did.
That was a lot of fun. Yeah,
that was a lot of fun. We'll keep up the good interviews. We love hearing you.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thanks for the call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Have a great day. Bye-bye. Anything you want to say, venture in, 347-857-4505, or on the Twitter feed at AB Writes. So a lot of musical birthdays the last week or so, and another one, his boyish good looks. He still has boyish good looks, even though he's 67 years young. Peter Noon from Herman's Hermits, he's into something good. He's on the oldies circuit and looking and sounding great.
Like a
birthday candles. I'm the Amy Beth Arkowy Show, Herman's Hermits, and I'm into something good. He's still touring, I don't think with the original Hermits, but still looking and sounding great. And don't forget, the second annual Grateful Bounty is coming back. We'll do it up on Friday, November 21st, live and thereafter for podcasts. The cornucopia of your favorite songs. These are just songs that make you feel good, songs for which you are grateful, songs that inspire or fill you with sheer joy. Requests and dedications are due, though. Trudy says she's holding firm because it takes some time to get them in the system by Tuesday, November 18th. You can do so via Twitter at AB Writes with the hashtag Grateful Bounty or at the website amybetharkowy.com. And join us. We had so much fun last year with our second annual Grateful Bounty. Back to the birthdays, the first lady of rock and roll, Grace Wing Slick, celebrated number 75 last week. And she doesn't sing anymore. Now she does mostly painting, but she's still around and her sound lives on and on. The Beer Plane of the classics, White Rabbit. Somebody to Love and White Rabbit, two psychedelic classics from Jefferson Airplane's 1960s canon, and Grace Slick celebrating her 75th birthday last year, the first lady of rock and roll, I think the first of the psychedelic pioneers to reach number 75. Happy birthday. And like Keith Richards, boy, she is a survivor because she's had a couple of rough and tumble rides with drugs and alcohol and DUIs and still standing tall and I think clean and sober. So good for you, Grace Slick. Not performing these days, but still painting. That's what she's turned her attentions to. My favorite anecdote about Grace Slick was back in the 60s when Richard Nixon was in the White House, his daughter Tricia invited everybody who went to Finch College in New York, all the alums, to do at the White House. And both of them went to that college. My mom went there, too, and said she didn't get the invite. They must have not had her address. But Grace Slick was invited under her maiden name, Grace Wing, but she showed up at the White House with Yippie counterculture leader Abby Hoffman on her arm, and she was promptly escorted out of the White House because Grace Slick had made, drum roll please, Richard Nixon's infamous enemies list. So she never made it to the punch bowl at the White House. Oh, well. These things happen. Love that story. Happy birthday, Grace Slick. Hey, reach out to the show via the website, amybetharkowi.com. You can friend me on Facebook. I'll hook you up with our Radio Graffiti update page. Or, of course, follow us on Twitter for the 24/7 conversation at AB Writes. And don't forget to follow the radio show at the Blog Talk Radio site. It's the Amy Beth Arkowi Show. Thanks again going out to David Laskin. Compelling narrative nonfiction is his game, and his new book, The Family, is certainly a winner. Find out more at davidlaskin.com. So, again, if you voted, you have the right to gripe, and I think I have a feeling we're going to have a lot to gripe about, but we'll just have to roll with those changes. Have a great weekend, whatever you do, wherever you go. Drive safe, play nice, dream big. Come back and see us on the Amy Beth Arkowi Show. Thanks to Trudy, Aurora, ML at TCS headquarters. Take care. Have a great week.
showtime is over.
Down, as Solomon Burke said, if you need me.